Growth and innovation. Two words that best describe the ETF industry. However, rapid growth and innovation creates a critical need for financial advisors and industry practitioners, education. Enter the ETF Institute, the first and only independent organization providing industry professionals and financial advisors with certification, education, and training on ETFs. Learn more about the Certified ETF Advisor designation by visiting cetf.org.
ETF Prime is hosted by Nate Geraci, president of investment advisory firm, The ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. Some guests appearing on this program may also be financial sponsors of ETF Prime. The ETF Store is not affiliated with VettaFi or any of its affiliates. VettaFi's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or indication by VettaFi of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, joining me will be Sean Tuffy, who's a financial regulation expert and an excellent follow on Twitter, or X, I might add, which is where we first connected. But this should be good. I have several topics for us to get into, including this multi-share class structure where a number of issuers have filed with the SEC to offer an ETF share class of their mutual funds. This is something Sean thinks could be a huge game changer for the industry. He actually says a much bigger deal than spot Bitcoin ETFs, which is saying something given how well those products are faring thus far. And so Sean's going to explain why he thinks this is such a big deal. And as part of that, we'll also get into the SEC's swing pricing proposal, which I've been told is a critical piece in getting approval for the multi-share class structure. So we'll discuss that. And then speaking of spot Bitcoin ETFs, I would say Sean is somewhat of a skeptic here. At least that's my read from his tweets. We'll see. But I have a number of questions pertaining to those ETFs that I want to get his take on. And then we may also get into the potential approval of spot Ether ETFs, and perhaps even the future tokenization of securities. This should be a fun and insightful conversation with a true expert in fund regulatory matters. Also joining me this week will be Ben Harburg, portfolio manager at Core Values Alpha. So Ben's going to spotlight their first ETF, which just launched in October, the Core Values Alpha Greater China Growth ETF, ticker symbol CGRO, C-G-R-O, which is being billed as an America First China ETF, meaning this will only own China companies that don't compromise U.S. national security or values. So we're going to take a look at exactly how they're doing that and what the investment case is here, including the investment case for China overall, because that's been a really tough place to invest. I actually have some stats around that that I'll share later. It's been just brutal. Now, to start this week, making his ETF Prime debut is Brian Coco, head of index products at VettaFi. And I'm looking forward to this. We are going to dive into the world of index construction, which VettaFi is now playing a growing role in this space. So we'll talk about that and what Brian is seeing in terms of future trends around indexing. So let's chat with Brian now.
Now we're joined by the experts at VettaFi, a new data analytics and thought leadership company that is transforming financial services from an industry to a community, one relationship at a time.
We can deliver value to that advisor because that's what they're telling that they want to engage in. We want to make sure that we're putting the right pieces of content in front of them at the right time.
Brian, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Nate. Really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. So look, since this is your ETF Prime debut, I thought it might be good to have you first introduce yourself to our listeners. I know prior to VettaFi, you were head of indices at JP Morgan Asset Management. Prior to that, you were over at CIBC Capital Markets and Credit Suisse. All of those roles being heavily involved with global indexing strategies. So perhaps talk a little bit about those experiences and then take us through your current role at VettaFi.
Sure. So throughout my career, I've really been lucky enough to work in almost every aspect of the indexing business. I got my start at Credit Suisse building bond indices when those were still mostly run by big investment banks. And at my time there, I was able to also build out a suite of quantitative investment strategies focusing on commodities and FX, interest rate derivatives. So I really got my feet wet over there. Took it over to CIBC, where I was in a structuring role, multi-asset, doing commodities and equity derivatives as well. In 2019, JP Morgan tapped me to head indexing, and that role was really focused on factor products, both in equities and fixed income. Also, we built some carbon transition indices at the time. So a number of different initiatives over at JP Morgan. But a few years ago, when I got the call to come and run the index business at what was then Alerian and quickly became VettaFi, I knew there would be a much more interesting opportunity to really put all these different skills to work. And the last few years, we've really built out this business, starting with two index companies, and then we've acquired since Robo Global and EQM Indices.
Yeah, it's amazing. Actually, talk more about that, because right now, I show that VettaFi has over 300 indices under its umbrella, including indices powering 88 ETPs with some $34 billion in assets. And it's interesting because I'm not sure some people realize the behemoth that VettaFi is starting to grow into on the indexing side. So tell us more about that and everything you're continuing to build out here.
That's right. We've really grown quite fast. Since I got here, we've almost tripled in the number of the amount of assets under management or under indexing. And, you know, we really want to be able to compete for every new indexed ETF that's out there. So some of that growth has come from acquisition of buying Robo Global, who's one of the first leaders in disruptive technology and thematic investing. And some of it's come through winning business from our competitors, some switch opportunities and new things. We haven't launched very many indices under the VettaFi brand, but we're starting to. We recently had a couple of launches up in Canada with CI Financial on an enhanced value and enhanced momentum indices. So we're really excited about, bringing all these brands together. Every time we acquire one of these companies, it's not just about bringing in the assets and bringing in the indices. It's really about bringing in the people. And each one of these acquisitions have come with amazing people that have really moved the needle on what our capability set is.
Did I see correctly that you're powering some of the O-Shares ETFs?
That's right. So one of the companies that formed the original VettaFi was a company called S-Network, which was often behind the scenes of other people's factor indices. The team at O-Shares had a really great idea on specific factors and weighting algorithms they wanted to use. And they really needed an index provider to supply a starting universe and to bring that idea to life, right? And so we partnered with them many years ago on an entire suite of products focused on quality dividends.
All right, so I love that you just said bring that idea to life, because you may not be aware of this. Last year, you actually had one of my favorite recent quotes, which I did talk about on the podcast at that time. I believe this was following the acquisition of EQM indexes. But let me read this. You said, quote, "A great investment idea can often remain just that, an idea. But with a well-constructed index, great investment ideas can become great investments." And I just love that, Brian, because I feel like investors only see the end product, right? They see the ETF or they see the mutual fund, but they don't always think about the index construction that led to that. And so I'd love to have you just talk more about that process at a high level. If you could just take us behind the scenes on how a great investment idea actually does turn into a great investment.
Sure. Well, first, the index development process is by its nature iterative. People show up with an idea and then you have to test it, and you have to test it over and over again. And so we tried to design our index platform, which we call the Index Factory, in such a way that was set up for partnership and set up for that the iterative nature of the process. Being a true partner to the ETF issuer community really means having the ability to test new ideas using innovative data sets and open architecture. We have to be able to not just to show results, but really answer the why of how did we get those results. And how is it going to impact a client portfolio, right? What is the factor exposures? What does the attribution look like? So those are the questions that we find ETF issuers increasingly want answers to, and advisors really want to understand what they're buying and what's inside the ETF. So that's what we hope to achieve with our platform.
Can you talk more about the data sets? Because obviously that's a critical component here when you're talking about building indices. I'd love to just hear more about the data that Vettafi is utilizing here.
Sure. We do rely on some of the largest data companies to supply us the core of what we do. So companies like ICE and FactSet, who have, big scalable processes. So as much as possible, we rely on those big firms. But ultimately, when someone has an innovative data set, the ability to quickly onboard that and test it, bring it into our data quality systems, and try to use it in an index is increasingly important. So we've tried to remain open architecture, and allows us to work with some really cool, innovative companies around that.
All right. So given your role and everything that Vettafi is now involved in, as you just described, I'm very curious, what are you seeing in terms of future index construction trends? Like, where is the puck heading? What are the hot topics of conversation right now?
I think there's three interesting areas I'd like to cover. The first being the concept of quality. I think everyone knows right now that they need to be laser focused on quality companies and are using traditional quality indices to do it. But what we've had is this historic run-up in interest rates over the last few years, and this massive overhang of debt that came during COVID that is going to start to come due over the next few years. Between 2025 and 2028, companies are going to have to refinance a lot of debt, and the amount of debt at significantly higher interest rates. When they do that, it could impact some companies' ability to continue to grow their dividend or buy back their stock, right? So figuring out which companies are more exposed is not rocket science, but it does require us to rethink the way the quality metric works. So what we've tried to do, for instance, is focus on profitability and solvency and look at forward-looking metrics of solvency to try to get in front of this trend, right?
Do you think we could see a second wave around smart beta ETFs? I feel like I've talked about this a little bit recently, but I feel like smart beta has been put on the back burner a little bit with the rise of active ETFs over the past several years. But with what you just described, obviously this would be built around an index looking to rethink the quality factor. Do you see a second wind or second wave for smart beta ETFs?
I really do, Nate. And the reason is, when interest rates are really, really low or negative in some countries, correlations rise, right? Companies can take on as much debt as they want, and it really doesn't matter at the end of the day. But now where we're back to somewhat normalized interest rates, historically normalized interest rates, these things matter a lot more. Debt service is certainly one of it, but even traditional value and growth factors are going to start coming into play in a much more predictable way during the next cycle. So we think this is the right time to look at your factor exposures and evaluate what are the factors that are going to be able to outperform in the next cycle.
Okay, so rethinking the quality factor. You said you had three trends. What are the other two?
The second one is around demographics. Again, this is like an obvious, somewhat of an obvious crisis that's coming, I think we heard yesterday China, you know, published their growth estimate for next year at around 5%. That's significantly lower than they've traditionally grown over the last few decades. And why is it happening? I think everyone understands that they have a demographic crisis on their hands. And that demographic crisis is not just hitting China. We can see it in Japan, in Taiwan, South Korea. And the beneficiaries of that demographic crisis may be some countries that have favorable demographics, like India or Brazil. And in the developed market side, you know, Australia is a growing country. Canada is a growing country. Rethinking the way our international exposures work to try to get a little bit away from market cap weighting might be appropriate given what is this next obvious crisis coming, right, in the form of demographics. We've tried to rebuild some of our developed markets and emerging market suite to take demographics into consideration. And we see clients really interested in that concept.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I know a lot of investors and advisors, demographics are a key consideration that they look at, particularly when investing in international markets. And so with what you just described there, it sounds like high level, if we're putting this through the index construction process, it would be weighting towards countries with more favorable demographics as opposed to market cap weighting. Is it that simple?
It is that simple. Within each country, we're still going to hold the same proportion of each of the companies that qualify, but we're just reweighting the countries to give us more favorable demographic exposure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, and then the third trend you're seeing is?
Well, the third trend is we're really trying to rethink the way broad-based sector indices work. I think traditionally people would just buy large cap sector exposure and use, you know, asset allocation techniques to adjust those exposures. And, you know, the thematic world is often disrupting some of those sectors. So the first thing we did is we tried to look at energy as an example. We have this 2050 goal, right? We're supposed to be 100% clean energy by 2050. So I think a lot of ETF issuers and index providers have come up with energy transition strategies that are really focused on just that clean energy bucket. But at Vettify, we think the path to getting to 100% clean energy still goes through fossil fuel companies. So what we've done is tried to design something that would, in a straight line, move us from fossil fuels to clean energy over the next 26 years to get to 2050, but do it in such a way where we're reweighting this combined portfolio to give us, you know, that exact exposure. So in 2015, 15% of our energy mix was clean energy, and 15% of the index should represent that, both in terms of number of names and market cap. What's really interesting about putting these two things together is both energy and clean energy are quite volatile, but together they're less volatile. And if you own a clean energy index, over time, all the good clean energy companies are going to get acquired by fossil fuel companies that are sitting on lots of cash flow that they can't necessarily reinvest in more fossil fuel projects. So it's really about owning your own disruption and being able to actually continue to hold those more technologically advanced companies that are going to get acquired by the larger companies.
This is another one I find really interesting. I'm not sure if you saw over the weekend, the Wall Street Journal actually had a piece on BlackRock, and the gist of the piece was they were talking about how BlackRock has moved away from the ESG acronym and really just ESG investing as a whole, but that they were focusing on this transition. And I think to what you're speaking to, certainly, you know, the energy transition, but also just investing in companies that are building out the clean energy infrastructure. And I feel like that is where ESG has evolved to. It's moved much more in that direction. I guess, would you agree with it? It sounds like it from an index construction standpoint. Any thoughts on what we saw from ESG over the past several years to where it may be heading moving forward?
I completely agree. I think people are looking for a bit of a decentralized approach to ESG. They want to attack certain areas, clean energy being, you know, on the forefront. But there's a number of ways to be able to do it. And I think they want more targeted exposures, and that'll also go for the S and the G in ESG, right? They want an index based on social justice or pure governance, and you know they don't necessarily want to mix those three factors together.
No, I think that's well said. I mean, I've often talked about how, from an investor's perspective, it's really difficult because they may look into an ESG ETF, a broad-based ESG ETF, and question why certain companies are owned. And the reason why, maybe they're scoring really well in energy, which outweighs maybe some of the negative things they have on the S or the G side. But that can be difficult for an investor to get their head around. And so I think you're right. By targeting each of these, it's much more understandable to the end investor. But Brian, we're going to have to leave it there. Great having you on the podcast. I'm sure we'll be doing this again. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Nate. Really appreciate it.
That was Brian Coco, head of index products at Vettafi.
Equities are the building blocks of any successful portfolio. From satellite exposure to core allocations, advisors must understand the best way to wield equities if they want to succeed. Join Vettafi on March 13th for the Equities Symposium and hear from industry experts and thought leaders. Register at etftrends.com. That's etftrends.com.
I am now joined by Sean Tuffy, who's an expert on all things financial regulation related. He has over 25 years of experience in the cross-border fund industry, including various senior roles at State Street, Brown Brothers Harriman, and Citi. And more importantly for me, he has some of the best memes you'll see out on Twitter or X, and he's now on the line with me from Dublin, Ireland. Sean, it's an absolute pleasure. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
You know, I love connections like this because we did come across each other on Twitter, and I quickly took a liking to your various memes. I think you know I enjoy posting a few memes myself, for better or worse. But more importantly, over time, I did notice your hot takes on various financial regulatory topics, of course, including one of my favorites, crypto ETFs, Bitcoin ETFs, which we'll get into. But I guess first, just tell us a little bit more about your background when it comes to financial regulation.
Yeah, sure, no problem. So I've been in the area of financial regulation basically since the end of the since the onset of the GFC. So essentially I've been working in Brown Brothers Harriman and the administration arm custody in Europe, are going through what I sort of dubbed the great re-regulation post-GFC. And it quickly became clear we needed to sort of have a clear view on all the regulation coming down the pike and what it meant for ourselves and what it meant for our clients. So I sort of fell into it, if you will. And then I've sort of spent the last decade plus tracking the sort of all the onslaught of regulation that started in Europe, to be honest, and now has sort of come to the U.S. shores lately.
When did you first start posting on Twitter? And was there a FinReg angle from the beginning?
Yeah, it always was a little bit. Actually, I started almost 10 years ago, I guess, a little over. At the time, I was a social spokesperson for BBH, and it was the idea was to sort of engage with the marketplace through Twitter. And sort of as Twitter developed and memes developed, it sort of became a way to communicate around what is admittedly a boring topic. And I find memes a good way to sort of communicate and discuss financial regulation and about as humorous a way as possible.
All right. So look, that's a perfect segue because we're going to cover a number of topics, many of which you have tweeted about. And let's just start with the obvious one, which is spot Bitcoin ETFs. And I actually want to read one of your tweets. So this was from January 3rd, before these things launched. So you said, quote, regulated entities selling a regulated ETF on a regulated exchange via registered investment advisors is apparently the future of Bitcoin, and it's never not going to be funny. And I get the sense from that you're not necessarily the biggest fan of these products. Is that a fair characterization?
I mean, it's a little fair. I mean, I think that tweet was more, as you know as well as I do, and your listeners probably do, there's this ethos around Bitcoin and Satoshi launching this alternate financial system. But ultimately, like, it's sort of become a mainstream asset that's being accessed through the most regulated vehicles imaginable. And I think that's just sort of funny for something that started as trying to reinvent the financial system.
Yeah, and I think that's the aspect. I think a lot of people struggle with that because I think you're right. Bitcoin came into existence after the GFC, and there was a lot of consternation over the centralized monetary system. And so now you have this wrapped into a regulated vehicle. I'm not going to get down that path for our conversation, but I think you're right. I think certainly people struggle with that. Let me ask you this. Regardless of what you think about spot Bitcoin ETFs, do you think the SEC should have approved these? Or do you think they were just boxed in with a grayscale lawsuit? Like, I'm curious from a regulatory perspective, how do you think the SEC handled this entire process?
Yeah, so I think, if we're being completely honest, the second the CFTC designated Bitcoin as a commodity, the die was cast to some extent. And obviously that was 10 years ago. Futures were approved a few years after that. And the SEC was sort of really running out of road into not allowing the Bitcoins to happen. And certainly the grayscale lawsuit was sort of the final accelerant to the approval. So I think they were sort of boxed in to approving no matter what. I think over the last decade, Bitcoin has gone from being sort of, as we talked about, this outlaw asset to probably the most generic mainstream crypto asset imaginable, which is weird for a lot of people to admit. And so I think that the SEC could have always rejected it if it chose to. The political realities and the market realities probably made it impossible.
How do you feel about the fact that the SEC did approve spot Bitcoin ETFs, but there's really no regulatory framework in place for crypto overall? It's almost hard, just if you're taking a step back, to get your head around that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I would say that's my biggest problem, is that they've approved these ETFs for an asset that is, you know, sort of traded in less than regulated markets with less than regulated entities, and but it is in a regulated wrapper. So I think it is weird to see this approval come through without the triggering framework. But I suppose the U.S. sort of does stuff back to front a lot of times when it comes to this sort of innovation.
Well, so look, so these products obviously are out on the market right now. I'm curious, have you been surprised by the initial response from investors? So I was checking this morning. I show a net $8 billion into these 10 ETFs. That includes over $9 billion in outflows from the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. And correct me if I'm wrong, but again, my sense in following you on Twitter was that you weren't overly bullish on the prospects for these products. So I'm curious what your initial impression has been of the investor interest here.
Oh, yeah, no, I think I am surprised as almost anybody. I think a lot of people thought that React, like, they would grow to be a big deal, but not sort of go as quickly as they have. So I think they've been an unqualified success. I mean, I've put my hands up. The investor demand is higher than I thought it would be. If you looked at sort of pre-launch and sort of the other sort of the BlackRock ETF trust that was out there and other products that weren't really going gangbusters, I assume that those who owned the ETF already, our Bitcoin already had exposure to it. So I did not expect such a strong start. So I think it's really impressive. And I guess the question will be, as you probably know, in other markets like Canada, where these products have launched, there's a quick ramp up and then a plateau. So it'll be interesting to see in the U.S. market if the plateau is just higher given the relative size of the market, or if we're sort of going to see sort of a continued upward trajectory.
Any thoughts specifically on those outflows from GBTC? And I'll color that by saying, you know, it's interesting because they came to market on the day all the other spot Bitcoin ETFs launched with something like $28 billion in assets. And if you look today, I think they're now above that. And of course, that's been driven by the rise in the price of Bitcoin itself. But, right. You know, there was a lot of chatter around their approach to the market from a fee standpoint. Of course, they're priced way higher than all the competitors. And I was critical of that from the outset. Yeah. But you look now, it looks like a pretty good business move for the time being. Any thoughts on the outflows from GBDC and then just their fee strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've seen substantial outflows, which I think we all expected. Part of it was sort of the closing out of that discount trade when they sort of moved to the ETF status. And I think I expected more, like you, because they are charging a lot more for what is essentially the same product. But I think what I hadn't appreciated is the prices have gone up now to the point where if you're in there, a long-term investor, you probably have these unrealized gains, and is it really worth realizing the gains to save the money on the fee structure? So I think they probably were smarter than a lot of people thought to keep their fees higher, knowing they had sort of a more captive audience. Now, I think the question is, you know, long term, you probably won't see as many inflows as the money will certainly flow to the cheaper products. But as long as the price stays up and investors don't redeem, then, you know, they have a pretty nice business still.
Yeah, and you almost wonder if that was part of their calculus, right? That they said, okay, we know spot Bitcoin ETFs are coming to market. Maybe they had high confidence that there would be this wave of initial demand that we're seeing that would help catapult the price of Bitcoin up. And even though they knew they would have outflows, of course, the price of Bitcoin rising would compensate for that. Who knows? But I could see that being on their on their game board there. Okay, so obviously with the demand we've seen from spot Bitcoin ETFs, I don't think it's any surprise that issuers are now looking to spot Ether ETFs, and I'm guessing salivating over the potential prospects here, given the demand we've seen from spot Bitcoin ETFs. What do you think happens there? Do you think the SEC will approve spot Ether ETFs? Are you watching that at all?
Yes, I'm watching it, and it's weird because, as you know and you've indicated, I was sort of bearish on the SEC approving Bitcoin ETFs for the longest time, probably longer than I should have been. But I actually think the Ether spot ETFs will come sooner than some people are predicting out of the market. And I think the simple reason is, if you read the statements from Gary Gensler around approving the Bitcoin ETFs, the sooner they draw a line under crypto that's been approved by the CFTC as a commodity being put into regulated products, the sooner they can have that line against more meme coins, if you will. So I think it's in their interest to approve it quicker to avoid potential lawsuits, because they're getting sued on like a million fronts right now. So I just think it's pretty easy to stand over and say, look, these are approved commodities, they have futures, there's a marketplace. It's very hard. I mean, they can always deny that they want to. I just think practically they're not going to. But I think that raises the question, how popular will they be with the investing public, as sort of Bitcoin is crypto to, you know, mainstream in retail in a lot of ways, and how big of a deal Ether will be is a bigger question.
You mentioned the CFTC a couple of times already, and I've seen you tweet quite a bit about sort of this jockeying between the SEC and CFTC on regulating crypto. I believe you've called it a turf war. I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here, but can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, I agree with you, and I think if you look at the prospects for spot Ether ETFs, as you know, we have CME traded Ether futures. That was a huge catalyst behind Grayscale winning the lawsuit and ultimately spot Bitcoin ETFs coming to market. But for people who aren't familiar, I mean, you said maybe the SEC, they'll approve the spot Ether ETF and then try to draw a line in the sand. I agree with that, but I'd love to have you talk a little bit more just about the interplay between the SEC and CFTC on this.
Yeah, no worries. So, I mean, I think the U.S. is one of the few countries that has sort of multiple securities regulators, basically. And so what you have with crypto is this gray area where does it fall, and the CFTC has sort of about a decade ago decided to be the cool uncle and approve Bitcoin and Ethereum and sort of been more pro-crypto. But they only regulate half the market, so that put the SEC, which has been sort of more decidedly bearish or skeptical of crypto, in sort of a top spot. And so part of the issue when you look at the overall regulatory of the market is it's not clear who is responsibility for the crypto market. So there are various bills in Congress that suggest the CFTC should be in charge. The SEC claims it should have sort of primacy, and that sort of really leads to a lot of confusion and creates a lot of this ambiguity that could be otherwise avoided.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, it gets back to what we were saying previously, and you just touched on that there's no regulatory framework in place. Congress has yet to do that for crypto. I think until that happens, we're going to continue to see this turf war. And it actually, I want to move on here because I think we spent enough time on crypto. But, you know, on that note, I mean, any thoughts on, as we look ahead to the future, any thoughts on tokenization and real-time settlement of securities? Because some would say that's where all of this is heading. Now, again, we'll need to have a regulatory framework in place. But do you think that's pie in the sky type stuff? Or do you think that's realistic over, say, the next, I don't know, decade or so?
So I guess we should say that for stuff like real-time settlement, you really don't need the underlying sort of DLT crypto technology, right? Like, you know, there are some markets that are offering T plus zero today. You could move there without DLT. But tokenization and real-time settlement have always been put forward a lot as sort of real-world use cases you want for sort of crypto technology, though they haven't really materialized in the last decade, right? So the Australian exchange sort of famously spent tens of billions of dollars trying to put a DLT solution in, only to abandon it. So I still think we're a while off from any real big bang real-world amplification. I think we'll hear a lot about tokenization of stocks and of funds and of possibly ETFs, but it's always kind of hard to understand to what end beyond just using the technology. So I think it's still a while off before we really see it.
All right. With that, I think that's enough crypto. I appreciate you indulging me on the topic. Let's move on and talk multi-share class structure. And once again, I'm going to read one of your tweets. So this was from February 2nd. You said, quote, "The Bitcoin carnival has been fun, but the ETF share class thing is the actual ETF story of the year." So explain yourself. Why will this be the story of the year?
I mean, I guess it's simple. Like, I mean, simple numbers, I guess, is the way I put it. Like, you know, you quoted there's $8 billion in net inflows into the Bitcoin ETFs, and sort of they're not, you know, not insubstantial, but there are trillions of dollars sitting in mutual funds right now, especially in 401ks. And if there would be a way to hook the benefits of an ETF up to traditional mutual funds, such a much bigger opportunity for the ETF ecosystem to expand and continue the progress of sort of the complete ETFization of asset management in the U.S. So, you know, you look at all the tens of thousands of funds, trillions of dollars in mutual funds that could benefit from being part of an ETF ecosystem. I just think it's such a bigger deal.
Yeah, and it's interesting, just over the past week or two, I've seen several analysts within the ETF space say something along the lines that we're talking potentially thousands of ETFs that could come to market as a result of this. And I think the case is clear in that we know retirement plans, so 401ks, 403bs and such, that's really the last bastion for mutual funds. You know, they're still dominating those platforms. And so what the share class structure would do, it would allow them to keep that lucrative cash cow retirement plan business, but then pursue the much higher growth ETF market. Not rocket science here, but you know, that's high level the case. Let me ask you this. I mean, do you think the SEC is actually going to get comfortable with this structure anytime soon? Of course, Vanguard is using it, but they're only using it for index-based products. I believe all of the filings we have out there now, I think there's seven or eight, are all for active products. Of course, Vanguard's patent on this expired last May. But do you think the SEC is going to get comfortable with this? I know they have concerns regarding cross-subsidization and one share class supporting the other. What do you think happens
here? Right. So I think in general, the SEC is not immune to having buyer's remorse when they approve stuff. So I think if you were to really get the SEC in the room, they're probably never thrilled that they approved the Vanguard ball in the first place, and probably were happy that a patent protected them from having to deal with this for a number of years. It's kind of similar to, you probably remember when the SEC approved a bunch of levered and inverse ETFs and then stopped doing it for a decade because they had some sort of doubts about that. But I think they will have a hard time holding out forever. So I think they will, you know, the pressure will build. The sort of cross-subsidization of classes, the same concerns theoretically exist for index funds. They're not unique to active funds. So I think that a lot of their arguments are going to fall down under scrutiny. So I think it will probably be eventually a case of them approving it. And I guess it will probably be like we saw with the Bitcoin ETFs, where it will be sort of a batch approval of a number of the applications.
One thing I wanted to ask you about here, and again, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but when I was at the recent exchange conference last month, there was a lot of discussion around the SEC's swing pricing proposal, which I've seen you tweet about. And, you know, the thought here was that the SEC will want to first push that through before allowing the multi-share class structure. Do you agree with that? And maybe for the layman, can you explain the basics around that swing pricing proposal?
Yeah, so I've heard the same thing. I'm not sure I believe it, but I could definitely see the SEC using it as a carrot and stick mechanism to get swing pricing through. I guess the short answer is swing pricing is something that sort of was really developed in European mutual fund space and started life as something called an anti-dilution levy. And essentially, the idea is that if there are large inflows or outflows, that could materially impact sort of existing investors and fund prices, the large deals get charged a surplus, so they essentially pay for their own trading. That results from the subscription redemption activity. And so regulators, in particular the SEC, have hung on to this idea that it could be a potential way to mitigate the impact of mutual fund runs, quote-unquote, on mutual funds during times of market stress.
So interesting. So I guess just to summarize here, I mean, and not holding you to it, do you think all of this will get pushed through in 2024? Is this more of a 2025 type initiative? How do you see this playing out?
So I think a decision on swing pricing probably gets pushed through before the end of the year. Now, whether it is full swing pricing, which, not to go down the rabbit hole, but to do swing pricing in the U.S., you have to rewire the entire mutual fund market, which mm-hmm. is why the ICI and others are very against it, because it's a huge effort. So they might ultimately go with what they did with money market funds and just say you have to add a sort of a flat fee on top of funds in the event of huge price surges. But I think they will get that. They are likely to get that done before they make decisions on the applications around the Vanguard model, because there is less pressure on those. You know, that hasn't totally built yet. So it wouldn't surprise me if we don't see those till 25, but the swing pricing decision in 24.
All right, just a few minutes left here. Anything else have your attention in the ETF space? I feel like I've seen you tweet about SMA to ETF conversions. I know you've talked about the quote-unquote ETF tax loophole, which I don't think is going away anytime soon. I know you've talked about ETFs moving to T+1 settlement. I think I saw something on that the other day. Anything in particular have your attention right now?
Yeah, I think, sir, the broader macro theme is sort of the continued sort of ETFs eating the world, if you will, our asset management world. So that includes SMAs becoming ETFs. You know, in Europe, the ETF market is smaller by comparison, but growing. And so they're having their own discussions around the share class models, which I think are worth paying attention to if you're sort of, especially a U.S. manager looking to enter into the ETF market space in Europe. I agree with you. I'd like to make fun of the tax loophole, but it's not going anywhere anytime soon. So, And I think the other interesting thing to sort of pay attention to is how, since the sort of COVID market stress at the, you know, in early February, March 20, regulators have become much more amenable to ETFs and their structure and how the sort of the market-based structure and how they are resilient to sort of market shocks, which is sort of a very good positive for the industry, which spent, you know, a decade being accused of potentially being a huge systemic risk.
No, I love that last point. I mean, I've talked a lot about that, and obviously not just from a regulator perspective, but obviously end investors as well. I think what we saw during the quote-unquote COVID crash and then the Fed coming in, buying bond ETFs, all of that made both regulators and investors so much more comfortable with the structure. But Sean, we're going to have to leave it there. I really appreciate you taking the time. This was a lot of fun. Glad we could connect. I'll tell you my one goal moving forward is to ensure that you don't turn me into a meme on Twitter. So hopefully I can achieve that. We'll see. But thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
That was financial regulation expert Sean Tuffy. I'm now joined by Ben Harbert, portfolio manager at Core Values Alpha. They're behind the Core Values Alpha Greater China Growth ETF, ticker symbol CGRO, C-G-R-O, that just launched in October. And I'll tell you, it's an interesting concept. So it obviously invests in China, but this only holds companies that don't compromise U.S. national security or values. It's a unique approach. And Ben is now on the line with me. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be with you, Nate.
All right, so let's jump right in here. This ETF is billed as an America First China Equity Investment Strategy. Obviously, you are seeking alpha here. You're seeking out performance. This is actively managed by you. So take us through your process. How exactly are you going about this?
We start top down. We look at the large industry trends that we think are going to shape China growth over the coming years, and also that are, you know, going to see some nice pops in the short term. We are actively managed, so we can trade in and out of positions. And then we look to find a common ground between that China growth and American interests. And so we spend a lot of time in Washington, kind of with our ear to the ground, understanding what's coming down the pipe in terms of sanction, what types of businesses might be perceived or are falling afoul of American national security interests or American values. And then we take all those ideas that we've kind of whittled down into those core, what we believe to be growth drivers, and those have to be actively managed because it's just so challenging to passively approach this market today. And then we filter them with our risk committee. And our risk committee is made up of current and former, both people that are active in the U.S.-China dynamic, maybe from a think tank or, you know, kind of outside of government policy perspective, and then those that were just recently sitting in government, so people that were in the White House national security types of seats, military or other roles. And they really help us kind of do another layer of due diligence beyond what would even be possible kind of from a desktop. And that enables us to kind of get that list to a place where we feel like we are protected against current and future derivations. And then, you know, we end up with a list of names that actually outperform the indices. You know, we kind of do well by doing good. And so by being actively managed, but also by putting that risk screen in, we end up outperforming, not underperforming.
And just to be clear in terms of the types of shares that you own, because there are a lot of different shares in China, my understanding is you do hold mainland China, Taiwan, and then China special administrative regions such as Hong Kong. Is that correct?
That's right. We're not restricted, and so we have a pretty wide berth. And we also invest in, say, U.S. businesses that have significant exposure to China as well.
All right. So I want to come back to the ETF in a moment, but as I know you're well aware, China has been a difficult place to invest from a performance perspective. And I know we've had an uptick here recently, but I saw a few stats last week from strategist Todd Sohn that I wanted to share with you. And I know you're intimately familiar with these, but they're almost hard to believe. So over the last 30 years, the MSCI China Index has posted a total return of 0%. 0%. That's been accompanied by 22 intra-year corrections of 20%, which if you compare that to the S&P 500, the S&P 500's had 6, and an average annual correction of 30%, which is twice the S&P 500. And so, Ben, given that, why should investors even consider allocating to China right now?
Sure. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, obviously there's plenty of counter statistics we can give. For instance, that the CSI index is up to like 3X over the last 30 years and whatnot. But I think the key to understand is that we are, we invest in cycles. And there have certainly been incredible bull markets within China. We entered China as a private firm, investing as a private side in the 2010s. And made tremendous returns investing in the growth of the China technology boom. And we believe that, you know, we're entering a similar cycle today. And so, we don't have to be China apologists to do well in this fund, and we don't have to be, China 50-year investors. What we need to do is think kind of week to week, month to month, what names will really drive, outsized growth, particularly in the verticals that we're excited about, things like domestic brands and consumption, domestic travel, kind of Chinese companies that are going global and bringing hardware and software to global consumers, and then some of the businesses that are really kind of doing that integrated supply chain in the hardware space, the likes of the EV makers. The way we look at all of them is that they are monstrously underpriced. And if you were to kind of look for an easy strap line, it might be something like, America today, particularly S&P, is trading at all-time historic highs. Well, our market and our companies are fundamentally still doing very well, are trading at historic lows. And in many instances, these companies are trading below their pre-IPO levels or even trading below the cash that they have on their balance sheet. And so our view is that we're essentially sitting in China 2010, and we're getting in at the ground level for the next boom into businesses that are dominating in their respective verticals, and we can go into some of those, and that are really kind of fueling that fourth industrial revolution where China is a global market share leader. So that's what we'll focus on rather than kind of the long, long trends.
Let me ask you this. So obviously, I'm assuming you believe your approach that you just described with SEGRO is superior to other options out there. But if you'll just indulge me for a moment, as you know, there are numerous other index-based ETFs and actively managed China ETFs. And so the question I have is, if you're sort of limiting the investment universe here to only companies that align with American interests and values, what are you giving up? Because typically, when you constrain an investment universe, that should lead to underperformance over time relative to a strategy that isn't dealing with a constrained universe. So what's the trade-off here with an ETF like SEGRO? Or am I not thinking about this properly?
No, you are. And ironically, our data proves it in this that we outperform the other both China active and passive managers that we would compare ourselves against over the period of our existence. But the reason why doing well by doing good is important for us is because if we can kind of ferret those types of businesses that might be falling afoul of U.S. values or national security interests early, we're avoiding future pain. We're avoiding companies that will see themselves ending up on some kind of a blacklist or a sanctions list, companies who might find themselves not able to access U.S. capital, U.S. supply chain, particularly core components. And so there is very much a fundamental economic driver behind this, that we are kind of preventing kind of future pain by dealing with it and cutting it out today. And our view, again, is that there are plenty of really strong businesses in China that aren't falling afoul of these and that are non-controversial. And because we're actively managed, rather than buying a basket of the market and having our overall returns degraded or diluted by some of those other bad actors or slow performers, we can just kind of surgically slice out the key areas of growth that don't fall afoul of these pessimism, and we end up with a better set of results than if we were to just buy a basket or a broader market ETF.
As I was thinking about our conversation here today and trying to come at this from the perspective of an advisor, even just a retail investor, I'm curious how you think they should approach emerging market exposure overall. Let me explain that. If I had a guess, and actually we can see it in the assets under management, we know many investors simply look to an index-based broad emerging markets ETF, like say VWO or IEMG. And even if they look to an actively managed broad-based emerging market ETF, fine. Now, clearly you're making the case that investors should sidestep some of the China companies that these ETFs own. And so let's say investors agree with that and they allocate to CGRO. I'm curious how you think they should pursue other EM exposures, because they can't do it through the quote unquote easy button approach of VWO or IEMG. So do you suggest individual country exposures to complement CGRO, or how should an investor or advisor think about incorporating this into a portfolio if they want that broad EM exposure?
Sure. And I should preface this by saying I'm kind of an EM junkie. I spent the last 18 years of my career in emerging markets in the Middle East, Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and East Asia. Our view is that this should be country by country, and that China, it's unfair to even clump it with other EMs because it's such a different beast. It is the global kind of complement to the United States across all of the kind of major corporate and technology verticals. So there will be a splinter net here, and you'll get kind of an American search engine if China search engine, an American hardware company, a China hardware company, and in many instances, they will live in balkanized worlds of operation. And so you can kind of double dip by investing in China parallel to the, particularly today's levels, and get exposure to a lot of those similar models that where there won't kind of be cross-border pollination. And then after that, the way we would look at it is go country by country, because, again, there's such a variance of regulatory environments, levels of corruption, levels of kind of macro issues, be it currency devaluations or other kind of impediments to growth across a broader basket of emerging markets. And so I wouldn't want to throw Brazil in the same basket as, say, Indonesia or Vietnam in the same basket as Nigeria. And so I think you've really got to do look at them independently, and we do as well. We'll actually be launching a India-only ETF following up on this China ETF for similar reasons.
Ben, just a few minutes left. I'm going to see if we can put your entire China investment thesis into like 3 minutes. You get to demonstrate your knowledge of the Chinese market right now. I'd love to have you just talk about that country's economy overall, because earlier we highlighted the lack of stock market performance. But putting that aside, there are clearly some scary headlines out there to the average investor and advisors. I've seen headlines around their property markets, banking system, demographics, which I actually touched on earlier in the podcast. Obviously, geopolitical concerns. There's a lot out there. And so what's the case for future economic growth in China?
Well, I would say first that all of those negative narratives, and there are plentiful, as you said, have benefited in some ways our strategy, because our view is that we're positioning China to kind of be the contrarian trade of the next several years. And our view is that when you achieve a contrarian trade is you come into a market when there are negative narratives around a certain asset that aren't necessarily true to form and true to the realities on the ground. So, for instance, the property market has been a major negative narrative around China. But the reality is that when you scratch beneath the surface and you really do your homework, you find that it's nowhere near the scale of what we experienced in the West and in kind of the GFC in 2008, that the China regulatory environment, actually for those of us sitting on the ground, is far more predictable and tradable, and it's easier to kind of position yourself within the regulatory slipstream than try to fight against it. And when you do so, you end up with an incredibly lucrative stream of investment opportunity. And so if everyone is running for the hills from China for non fundamentally driven reasons, the Chinese companies on an individual basis, and again, within our specific verticals, are thriving, that tells us that we're really well positioned and focus on those names rather than be broader China apologists. So for instance, we love
integrated supply chain kind of fueling the fourth industrial revolution space. Someone like BYD just became, you know, the world's largest exporter of electric vehicles. Sales were up 62% in 2023, and 84% of that were EVs. China tourism, for instance, domestically is migrating back home rather than going abroad, and that resulted in, you know, over the New Year period, this year, for instance, tourism spending being up 44% year-on-year and 8% over pre-COVID times. So the numbers are fundamentally sound, and what we're excited about is there's kind of a dam building where there's about $6.1 trillion of household savings in China, which haven't been unlocked. China's not yet really been truly a domestic consumption-led economy. Chinese sovereigns and kind of other state funds are only allocated about 6% to local stock markets, where in the U.S. we're about 30% allocated. And so there's a huge amount of demand coupled with capital that's sitting on the sidelines that can flush into these markets as soon as that narrative starts to shift. And so we're positioning ourselves to get ahead of that flow, and we think that it could be one of the kind of most hated rallies in history, just as people who sat on the sidelines and say Bitcoin over the last year or two are now kicking themselves. I think you're going to see similar reactions to China come this conversation, say, a year from now.
Well, Ben, I think you did an excellent job of squeezing the investment thesis into a few minutes. Really interesting perspective. Congratulations on the launch of this ETF. I certainly wish you the best of luck. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Nick.
That was Ben Harburg, Portfolio Manager at Core Values Alpha. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank one of our sponsors, Calamos Investments. If you would like to learn more about Calamos ETFs, you can visit calamos.com/ETFs. Next week, I will be joined by VettaFi's Todd Rosenbluth. We're going to check in on my 2024 ETF predictions and potentially make a few new ones as well. Until then, have a great week, everyone.